Hello, Failing Boldly listeners. This is Christian Kuhn. I hope you are having a blessed Christmas season. Because this is the Christmas season, I'm going to rebroadcast one of my favorite episodes. This was a conversation I had with Father James Martin, one of my favorite authors, and this came out about 2 years ago. So I hope that you enjoy it. As we go into 2020, I'm going to be better about putting out podcasts on a regular basis. So right now the plan is to send them out on the second and fourth Thursdays. And so you can mark that down. I'm sure red letter day for you to listen to conversations that I have. Occasionally there will be some rebroadcasts, but for the most part, they'll all be conversations that I have for the first time. So I hope you will subscribe to the podcast either on podcast software on Apple or on Spotify or wherever else you get your podcasts. Looking forward to new guests in 2020. And as always, you can reach out to me if you have questions. And you can find me on my website, christiankuhn.com. And so, here's Father James Martin.
Hello, and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. I'm excited about this week's podcast because my guest is Father James Martin. Father Martin is a Jesuit priest, editor-at-large of America Magazine, and best-selling author of such books as Jesus, A Pilgrimage, and The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything. He has appeared on many major radio and television networks, ranging from NPR's Fresh Air to Comedy Central's The Colbert Report. In 2017, Pope Francis appointed him to be a consultor for the Vatican's Secretariat for Communication. In this episode, we talk about his latest book, calling for the Catholic Church to be more welcoming of LGBT Catholics, how he responds to those who criticize his writings, and what spiritual practices keep him grounded. I hope you enjoy it. Well, Father James Martin, thank you so much for being on the Failing Boldly podcast.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
So I was wondering if you could, I usually ask guests to talk a little bit about their own vocation and calling. And so I was wondering if you could share a little bit about how you got to be where you are now.
Yeah. How long do you have? I'll give you the short version. I grew up in a Catholic family, not super religious, didn't go to any Catholic schools. Went to the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania as an undergrad, and then took a job at GE working with in corporate finance and then in human resources. And then, really realized that I was kind of in the wrong spot. It didn't really fit who I was, although I wouldn't have been able to say it back then that way. And one night came home and turned on the TV and saw a documentary about Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk. And that prompted me to read his book, The Seven Story Mountain, which I'm sure you've heard of.
I have, and have read.
Yeah, and that just seemed like a much more attractive and appealing life than what I was doing, his life in the monastery, about which I knew nothing. And that prompted me to sort of seek out people to talk about the priesthood with, and then that led to the Jesuits, which is a Catholic religious order. And that's sort of led how I got to be where I am. What was going on was God was working through my desires, I couldn't tell that at the time, and I certainly would have never used that vocabulary, but that was kind of what was going on. That appeal to monastic life was the way that God kind of, caught me like a fish.
Yeah, and I would encourage folks, when you drop the desires phrase in there, it's a very Ignatian term, and so I'd encourage listeners to go to the Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything and read more about that.
I would encourage that too.
Yeah, sure. I was wondering, at what point did you make the discernment that I want to go into writing and speaking versus being a parish priest?
Well, that's another good question. When you enter the Jesuits, when one enters the Jesuits, you're supposed to enter, as we say, indifferent, which basically means free. And, not attached to, I must do this kind of work or I must do that kind of work. And so, you're kind of given many different opportunities for ministry. I worked in homeless shelters. I worked with refugees for 2 years in East Africa. I worked at America Magazine for a year. And gradually I started to write more and more, when I was at America Magazine, obviously during my training, but also later on. So that when the time came for me to be missioned, as we say, the provincial, the regional superior, decided to put me in American Magazine. And I've been here for about 20 years. So it was kind of gradual. I really enjoy writing. And I think the fact that I was able to do it and getting things published and getting books published meant that the Jesuits, you know, saw me as someone who could write and who might be able to do that kind of ministry. And I love it. I'd frankly be happy to do this for the rest of my life, God willing.
Yeah. I'm sure you didn't, though. When you began the process of writing your first book and editing the magazine, I would imagine that early on you had no idea that you had become almost a cultural icon of sorts and that you would be on the Colbert Report and things like that.
Yeah, I would question if I'm a cultural icon. But yeah, you know, all that media work was an outgrowth of the work we do here at America Magazine, now America Media. And, you know, eventually you get on people's Rolodexes, which is kind of a data term, but, you know, you get in people's, you know, list of people to call. And if you're not totally crazy and you return their phone calls, you tend to get invited back. And that's what happened. So no, I didn't predict any of the kind of stuff that I'm doing now. That's for sure.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the Catholic Church and some of the things that we've focused on here on this podcast is sometimes when people feel like or sense or read that there is decline in their church, regardless if it's Protestant or Catholic, they want to see the success stories. And so what we've tried to do is talk a little bit and really reflect on how have churches, regardless of their denomination, gone astray. And so for you, in your own context and your observations about the Catholic Church, I know it's probably hard to name a few things of why there's been decline, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the Catholic Church has responded, both in helpful ways, perhaps in looking and reaching out to folks who may be disengaged with the Catholic Church, and also what are some things that maybe the church has not done or what are some things that they've done that have not been helpful in trying to reengage folks?
Oh, that's a huge question. I would say that, yeah, let's take it from, say, the 60s, you know, from the Second Vatican Council. Okay. You know, I think one of the things that they've done best, we'll start off with what they've done good, what we've done good, is the Second Vatican Council really was a turn towards the world and a way of encouraging the church and the people of God, which is, you know, all the people in the church and, you know, all believers, to really see it as the church in the modern world. And there were a lot of changes, such as saying Mass in the vernacular. You know, people would know that from going from Latin to English, you know, sort of a renewed understanding of our relationship with the Jewish people. I mean, on and on and on. You know, so Vatican II really, I think, transformed the church for the better. You know, at the same time, the culture was getting more and more secular and people drifted away from the church, as the Catholic Church, as they drift away from all churches. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, certainly in the last 10 years, the sex abuse crisis has really driven people away from the church, not surprisingly. We did not handle that well at the beginning. I think, you know, we ended up blaming it all in the media, which is ridiculous. But I think, you know, since then, the response, interestingly, I think has been very forceful in terms of, you know, rooting it all out, and such that we have no people in ministry now who are, you know, had any sort of credible accusations. And, you know, it's funny, the Holy Spirit is really the one that provides the response. And I think the biggest response to the decline and to people who were fleeing has been Pope Francis. And I always tell people that in the space of 10 short years, the image of the priest or a response to a priest or a person in a collar in the Catholic Church in 2002 was, you know, let's talk about the sex abuse crisis, or, you know, aren't all priests pedophiles? To today, where it's, oh, I love your Pope. You know, I love Pope Francis. I love what he's doing with the poor. I love how authentic he is. I love how warm he is. And that's just the Holy Spirit who has given us that person. So, you know, in terms of decline, I mean, in a sense, you know, the entire culture is getting more secular and busier and more distracted. So it's not surprising, but I can't tell you how many people have really come back to the church because of Pope Francis. It's just been extraordinary, and all for the better, I think. I really think he's a great guy.
Yeah. You mentioned three qualities in him that I think, I would imagine, I don't know if you intentionally did this, but I think sum up one of the ways that we try to reach out to folks too, in that working with the marginalized, authenticity and warmth. That those three things, which as you described the Pope, I would imagine that we're trying to have all of our communities of faith try to exude those same qualities.
Yeah, authenticity, certainly. And, you know, it reminds me of Jesus, as we always learn in theology. His words gave meaning to his deeds, and his deeds gave meaning to his words. So they were congruent. And there's a reason why people say Jesus taught with authority. You know, it's not simply what he's saying, but how he lived and who he was and what people felt about him. And so I think you see the same in Pope Francis. You see this great, to take one of those virtues, authenticity. And also, I think it's about time for the church to really be more vocal about its turn towards the poor, which is not to say that, you know, under John Paul and Benedict, we weren't, you know, caring about the poor. I mean, my gosh, the church does more in terms of social service agencies. And, you know, Benedict and John Paul both talked about it. But there's a certain focus and emphasis on it that simply wasn't there under those two popes. And I think people are responding to that as well. And, you know, as you said, people on the margins, there's an instinctive recognition that this is, in fact, what Jesus did. And so Francis teaches with authority because he is teaching what the man with authority taught.
Do you come across, I guess, how often do you come across Catholics who are particularly anxious about the future of the church? Or do you think that has changed because of Pope Francis?
Oh, no. I mean, I come across Catholics who are anxious about the future of the church probably every 5 minutes when I step outside into my office. I mean, every Catholic is.
Yeah.
For all sorts of reasons. I mean, you know, declining numbers of people at church, declining numbers of vocations to the priesthood and religious life. You know, I mean, on and on and on. The sex abuse crisis, just sort of fill in the blank. By the same token, I think Francis really has, you know, I don't want to put all of our eggs in one basket because he's not going to live forever. But there's a great sense of this is a way to be Catholic that we have not seen in a long time. And I always like to tell people, one of the great things about Francis for me is that for people alive today, they will always be able to say to themselves, that is a way to be Catholic that I saw and that was real and that happened. Mm. And no one can take that away from me.
Yeah.
And that's really powerful. I mean, it's, you know, it's like the story of Jesus. I mean, people, you know, the people who knew him treasured that memory. Of course, you know, we have to distinguish between Jesus and Francis. Francis is not going to rise from the dead. But there's this idea of kind of the, you know, holding on to the memory and that memory giving us courage to go forward.
Especially for folks who may not have grown up in the church or may not be able to cite chapter and verse of scripture, for them to see a living example of this is the way that you live the way of Jesus is super helpful.
Yeah. And, you know, gestures are as important. Jesus knew that, right? I mean, Jesus knew that his signs, as they say in the Gospel of John, as you know, or in the Synoptics, you know, his works of power. Those gestures for him, you know, often were miracles, but even just touching people or speaking with people was really important. And Pope Francis understands that. I think one of the most powerful ones is the embrace of that fellow who had that disfiguring skin condition in I think in St. Peter's Square in the Vatican. I think his name was Andrea Ricci. That photo that's around the world of, you know, of the Pope literally embracing this guy. And it speaks to something deep within us. It speaks to, as Christians, our understanding of what Jesus did. Even if you don't know chapter and verse, as you say, of the Bible, you know that Jesus did that. You know, it also speaks to what St. Francis of Assisi did in terms of embracing the leper. So it speaks to us. I think gestures speak to us in a way even more powerfully than teaching. But in the case of Jesus and in the case of Pope Francis, they're connected. They're united. I mean, Pope Francis says, you know, reach out to the marginalized, and he does do that. Pope Francis says, live simply, and he does do that. Pope Francis says, stick up for refugees and migrants, and he does do that. So, you know, he goes out and he visits them. So gesture is very important, and to have it embodied, right, as theologians like to say, is also very important.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've been the author of several books. I've mentioned one already, and another one I mentioned to you in the email that I enjoyed thoroughly was about humor and faith, called Between Heaven and Mirth. Your most recent book explores how the Catholic Church can be in relationship with the LGBT population, as the subtitle of the book says, where there is respect, compassion, and sensitivity.
And maybe not surprisingly, you've had your share of critics because of the book. I don't know if any of them have explicitly called you a failure, but certainly as some of the articles I've read, they've questioned your standing in the church. So I'm wondering, how do you persevere when you face criticism and have faced criticism like this?
Yeah, actually, they've called me much worse than a failure. They call me heretic, which is ridiculous. You know, it's important to say that the book builds on the Gospels and is in keeping with the Catechism. It's had the endorsement of, my Jesuit superiors, like at this point, three cardinals, archbishops, bishops. So, no, I mean, I expected some critique, but some of the stuff from the far, far right is kind of ridiculous. How do I respond to critics? You know, if it's thoughtful, I mean, I'm happy to engage them, right? I mean, not everyone's going to agree with me, obviously, and this book is not the be-all and the end-all. If it's stuff that's just crazy and homophobic and mean and, you know, just baseless, I mean, like charges of heresy, I ignore it, frankly. You know, early on, I got to a point where I said, look, not everyone's going to like me or certainly not love me or approve of me and not even agree with me. And so that's okay. You know, the book is meant to be a kind of conversation starter, and that's okay. But, you know, so I'm happy to mix it up with people. But, you know, when it gets ridiculous and you have these, you know, far right websites calling for my, laicization, as we say, kind of being kicked out of the priesthood, it's ridiculous. So, why would I listen to that stuff? It's like some crazy person shouting at you on the street.
Yeah. You said, I'm happy to mix it up with people. Have you always been that way? Or has that been something that you've developed?
I've kind of had to develop. You know, I don't think anybody likes to have, you know, people disagree with them. I mean, it's just kind of human. A friend of mine who's a writer said that, which I think is really funny, when a writer hands his work to another person to read, right? I mean, you probably have this experience too. He only wants to hear, or she only wants to hear one thing. It's perfect. But I've learned that, to take editing is really helpful. You know, I've had some great editors. And I think I've gotten used to how to respond to critiques and, you know, always be charitable and take the person, where they are and listen to what they have to say. And for the most part, I think with this book, the reaction has been overwhelmingly positive and almost like embarrassingly positive. You know, people hugging me and crying and all that kind of stuff. That's actually even harder to take in.
How so?
Well, it's just a little overwhelming. You know, I mean, the book is a very mild book. It's a very short book too. There's a new version coming out. It's a little longer in a couple months. But, you know, I basically am just talking about respecting people and listening to people and welcoming people, and to have people, you know, just as happened a couple of nights ago, you know, break down in tears when they talk to me. It's overwhelming. I'm very grateful, and I have to just see it as a kind of a confirmation of the book and of this project to build bridges. But, you know, it is, you know, it's kind of overwhelming. You want to really respect where people are.
Can you talk a little bit too, not just about the writing, not just about this book, but in your own vocation and making decisions about what steps to take next and following God's call, and in times when you have felt like you have not followed it, perhaps as God would have desired you to? What practices keep you grounded in your faith, and what do you fall back on in those moments where you feel like you're at a dead end or that you can't do anything right?
Well, that's actually an easy question for me. I just came from my spiritual director, so that helps. Spiritual direction, you know, talking with someone about your prayer and God in your daily life. The Jesuits have a practice called the examination of conscience, a.k.a. the examen, E-X-A-M-E-N. It's a Spanish word. And it's a review of the day where you start with placing yourself in God's presence. You are grateful for things, you know, sort of a way of sort of grounding yourself in gratitude. And then you go through the whole day, start to finish, to try to see where God has been, where God's present. And then you pray in sorrow for your sins, you know, which obviously will come up because we're not perfect. And then you ask God for the grace for the next day. So the point is, you're able to look back and see where God was. And that's really kind of clarifying. It's very grounding, because a lot of times we just sort of move on to, like, you know, okay, next, you know, Monday's done, now time for Tuesday. I do retreats every year for 8 days. you know, and I pray contemplatively in the morning. And, you know, to make that less vague, what are the kinds of things I would look for? You know, a sense of confirmation that this is the right thing to do. So, for example, I'll give you a very sort of practical example. I was up giving a talk at Boston College, which is a Jesuit school. And I was talking to another Jesuit, a younger Jesuit, actually. And I said, you know, it's funny, the more I give these talks on LGBT stuff, the more calm I feel and the less sort of worried I am about any pushback at all. And it's very freeing. You know, I found this sort of sense of freedom, whereas I really don't care. I mean, I care a little bit, but I'm not like losing sleep over it when people are responding negatively or attack me. And he said, you know, it sometimes takes someone from the outside, you know, to say it. He said, what a great confirmation, which is a Jesuit word, that God will confirm the rightness of your decision. And I thought, yeah, absolutely. It's a confirmation that I'm on the right path. And so in other words, I look for it in my prayer. I look for it in spiritual direction. I look for it even with friends to kind of keep me on the right path. And, you know, I'm basically trying to pattern my life after Jesus. And he's a, you know, I mean, it's pretty clear, I think, when you're following Jesus, when you're doing the right thing. I mean, I think standing up for the marginalized is definitely what he would want us to do.
Well, it sounds like you've got that really, as Jesus did, great balance of spending time individually with your examine or perhaps on retreat, but also making sure you're in community too, to get confirmation from others and feedback and sometimes pushback, I would imagine too.
Oh yeah. I mean, in the Jesuit community. Yeah. it really brings you back down to size. I mean, you know, I go home and I mean, I don't tell too many people this, but you know, I'll go to these talks and people will be crying and hugging me and standing ovations. And I'll go back to my Jesuit community with my brothers who I love. And they'll be like, oh, were you away? they're not giving me standing ovations. And you know, the thing is, I've often reflected on this. It really grounds you. And I'm very lucky to have a religious community. Sometimes, you know, it's tough, you know, that side of it. But you know, I mean, you can't get a big head. Everyone's doing their own thing, right? I mean, I live with like a middle school president. I live with, you know, someone who works in the province office. I live with a high school teacher. I live with some other people from America Magazine. I mean, everybody's doing their own stuff and it's all important. So it's not like one person is like raised up. And if I did, I think they'd just, you know, they'd probably throw a dinner roll at me across the table.
Yeah, because when you live life together, I mean, for the people who give you standing ovations and weeping at what you say, they see you for an hour, and they don't live with you. And so I would imagine in any family unit, they really see you in all facets of your life.
Yeah, and also, you know, I think that if I did do something like that, I mean, what am I going to do if I walked in and said like, oh, you know, I got a standing ovation? You know, but also, yeah, they'd probably like start to dislike me because of that. So there's also an internal guide that says you shouldn't talk about that stuff. It's crazy. And you know, I also know that from my brothers, you know, they too are getting their own kinds of standing ovations in their ministry, right? So we're all kind of doing stuff that's really important, I think, for the kingdom.
Yeah.
So in other words, you know, there's no one person that's seen as better than, right? Or
right,
more important in the community. Yeah, I mean, if Pope Francis came in or the Superior General of the Society of Jesus, it would be different. But among in my community, no, we're all just kind of, you know, hanging out together.
Yeah. Well, in addition to the many words you write for your books, you also have tens of thousands of followers on Twitter, and you've become a very active social media presence there too. What made you decide to make that part of your ministry?
Well, that was kind of a reluctant decision. One of my publishers, Loyola Press, who did a book called My Life with the Saints in 2006, said, you really should get a Facebook account, a public account. And I already had a Facebook page. And I thought, no. In fact, I told them, no way. I have too much stuff on my plate and I don't want something else to do. But in short order, I found out it was it's a real kind of ministry. So I have Facebook, public page, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat. And, you know, it's a ministry. It's a way to communicate people. It's a ministry of the word. I view it as a way of connecting people with stuff that they might not normally hear about, you know, videos, talks, articles, meditations, pictures, you know, because I work at a magazine, so we get that kind of stuff first. And, you know, to sort of spread the gospel through those ways. And, you know, Jesus used the media of his time, which is parable, and spoke to people in very everyday ways. And so why shouldn't we use a new kind of medium, you know, social media, to do the same thing?
And I would imagine, too, you had said earlier about for folks on the far, far right who come at you and it's easier for you to tune them out because what they say just makes no sense. And on Twitter, of course, I'm sure you get a deluge of that kind of feedback, too. And so are you also able to be as discerning on Twitter to know when to take someone seriously and when to just know that I'm never going to get anywhere with this person, so I'm not going to really bother to engage with them?
Oh, I think it's even easier on social media. Because you can figure out almost within five words if this person is, you know, crazy or mean or not listening. So on Facebook, you know, it's very simple. I mean, they say, Father Martin, you shouldn't even be a priest. I mean, you know, that person gets deleted, right? Some person, you know, who obviously has just set up an account called Refute James Martin, which I think is an actual account. Well, I'm not going to listen to that person. I mean, they're just kind of out to attack me. So what I do is I mute them. I mean, look, if people are thoughtful and actually have questions or, you know, interesting ways of looking at things or a critique that makes sense, I say, well, that's really interesting. Here's my response. In fact, I did it for my Building a Bridge book. I did a whole video of, you know, answers to the most common questions because, you know, it's important to dialogue. But if it's just, you know, crazy stuff or trolls, you know, I mute them on Twitter, which means that they can say whatever they want and I don't have to see it. And I ban and delete them on Facebook, the ban and delete button. And that's really, you know, that's for people who are really just attacking me or others, you know, just kind of going after them. So, because I also think it's important to create a space for people that they can feel comfortable in, particularly on Facebook. And on Twitter, why would I want to look at that stuff?
Correct me if I'm wrong on this. I thought I read somewhere for you that one of the reasons also you're on Twitter is just because Twitter can be such a sea of negativity that you wanted to have, in a sense, an island of hope or joy that you start every day with a tweet, a devotional tweet, so that there can be that people can go to and get something out of this form of media too.
That's true. And also that's where people are. I know that Twitter is, you know, especially used by media types, and I think it's good to evangelize them as well. But yeah, I mean, if I can do and now I think it's 280 words, which is great. You can do a little homily in that space, and so why wouldn't you want to do something like that? And it's also a good discipline for me. I like the idea of trying to get my homily, so to speak, in 280 characters. I think it's a great discipline. So I enjoy it. I mean, a lot of people say to me, oh, how do you spend so much time? I actually don't. You know, I'll post maybe five or six times on Facebook, maybe the same on Twitter, maybe once or twice on Instagram. And, you know, I'll check the comments from time to time, but that's it. I'm not constantly scrolling through every comment. I always laugh when people say on Facebook, how come you didn't answer my, you know, comment, or on Twitter, why didn't you respond to my tweet? And I always say, you know, I have a job. I have a job at a magazine, and it's not, you know, it's not kind of scrolling through comments. That's not to denigrate people, but right. I just don't have that much time.
Yeah. Well, you've been a model for me as far as that, especially on Twitter, and I do my best. I don't always get at it, but to do some sort of little devotional tweet in the morning, because I agree with you. I mean, I think it has to be somewhere for people can go and be reminded. And I appreciate your comment too about it as an evangelism tool too, just to let, especially in this world where some take on the name or title of Christian and they're acting in very un-Jesus-like ways, that there has to be others to be able to stand up and say, you can't make all your decisions of what Christians are like by looking at these other individuals.
Well, also, and when appropriate, call to account some of that behavior, you know, without using names. But, you know, I think, for example, when people use Christianity to justify things, to justify, you know, God forbid, something like recently, you know, like sexual abuse or sexual harassment or marginalizing refugees or immigrants or ignoring LGBT people. I mean, when that's used in a way that I think is antithetical to the gospel, it's important to kind of call that out and to kind of show people bluntly that this is not what Jesus asks us, you know. And I mean, I particularly am very concerned with refugees and migrants because I work with refugees, and it's also, it's just, it's so clear in the Gospels. So to really just continually remind people how clear Jesus is about welcoming the stranger. And I sometimes think, you know, like it or not, this is what he says. I mean, you may disagree with it, but you can't say that he didn't say it.
Well, I want to close with, as I do with all of my guests, is to asking if you wouldn't mind sharing a story or two of a person of failures from your own life. And this could be in any, whether personal or professional, and then how you responded to those failures.
Wow. That's another big question. I think that the biggest overall failure, I mean, I have specific ones, you know, sinful things that I've done, that's for sure. I could go on for, that's a whole other program.
I think that the biggest failure I had as a Jesuit was this desperate need to be liked. To learn more about her and her books, you can go to her website, Barbara Brown, or Facebook page.
With all that entails, and I think that's a
more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to ChristianCoon.com.
And it affected how
I was in community, how I was with my friends, what I wrote. My next conversation is with Keelan Blackwell, founder of the Chicago Eco House.
What happened was there was a guy in my community, sustainability to alleviate poverty, who just hated me.
Thanks again for listening.
He really hated me. And I was praying about it on a retreat, and I was praying about the passage in Luke, the rejection at Nazareth. Remember where Jesus stands up in the synagogue, of course, and he says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, and he's in Nazareth, his hometown, and everyone speaks graciously of him first, and then they drive him out to the brow of the hill because they get mad at him, you know, because he basically says, I'm not going to do the kind of miracles that I did elsewhere here because there's no faith. Anyway. So normally when, this is a long answer to your question, but I was praying about this on retreat, and I realized that normally when people preach about that, it's, oh, look at the townspeople. They didn't understand who was in front of them, i.e. Jesus, i.e. the Messiah. But I realized on this retreat that, you know, Nazareth is a small town of about 200 to 400 people, really tiny. So Jesus would have known them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus, he knew all those people. He had grown up with them for 30 years, presumably 30 years roughly. So when he stood up and said, basically, I'm the Messiah, he would have known or could have predicted pretty well what they were going to do, right? I mean, if I stand up in front of my Jesuit community and I say, I am the Messiah, or I am the greatest Jesuit ever, I know what they're going to say, right? They're going to like throw stuff at me. And so I asked Jesus in my prayer, what enabled you to do that? What enabled you to do that? And he said, this is one of the few times I didn't hear it orally, but I kind of felt it in my soul. One of the few times this happens to me is on retreat. Jesus responded very clearly with the words, must everyone like you? And I had to admit at that time in my life, the answer was yes. Everyone has to like me. So therefore, if everyone likes you, and I'm actually just connecting this as we are speaking right now to what I'm doing with the LGBT community. If everyone has to like you, you know, Jesus would have never gotten up in the synagogue to begin with. He would have never left Nazareth. He would have never left Nazareth. And I would have never really written this book. And so that was a great barrier to me to just really responding to his call. And I've really had to get over that. And I think it's been a kind of death to that self that needed everyone to, you know, for example, like everyone has to like my books. I mean, that's not the case anymore. So it's, I think it's a necessary move, and it's also, it's very freeing ultimately. So, cause that's what it's all about. It's freedom from something and freedom for something.
Yeah, there's a really wonderful quote. I have it hanging up in my office from Richard Rohr, who said, I have prayed for years for one good humiliation a day, and then I must watch my reaction to it. I think it's that for me anyway. I resonate a lot with what you're saying. It keeps me humble, and it helps me realize kind of what you said, not everybody has to like me. And if I worry about that, I can't have any kind of impact in my ministry.
Zero. Yeah, you can't even have a life. And, you know, it's funny, Richard and I are good friends, but I would take issue with that quote because I don't think you have to pray for humiliations. I think, you know, Thomas Merton, someone said to him, do you mortify yourself? Which is, you know, that physical mortification where they would like have little like whips and stuff to beat themselves, you know?
Uh-huh.
And his line was, life is mortifying enough. So I think, you know, life gives you these humiliations. And as one of my spiritual directors said, which sounds kind of sick, but it's true. No humility without humiliation. Mm. I mean, we would like to say, oh, I'm so humble and look at me. I'm so whatever and simple. But it really is those humiliations and that sort of bumping up against your own sinfulness and against life that I think really makes you humble.
Yeah.
I mean, this experience of this Jesuit hating me was a real humiliation. Mm-hmm. And I really had to kind of, that sort of, I think, led me to this, I would hope, freer state.
Yeah. Well, that's a good word to end on. Father James Martin, thank you so much for spending time with me today. And again, folks, his latest book is Building a Bridge, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. And I encourage folks to read that in addition to the other books that he has written. So thank you again, Father Martin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Father Martin for speaking with me. You can learn more about him and his books by going to harperone.com/James Martin. And he's also a great follow on Twitter at @JamesMartinSJ. I hope you will subscribe to this podcast, and if the Spirit moves you, to give it a good rating. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to my website, christiankuhn.com. Have a blessed remainder of the holiday season, friends, and thanks again for listening.